Ron is a very charitable man. He should have said to you that perhaps my main qualification for taking this talk is that having been 56 years in the workforce, I have made most of the stupid mistakes that it's possible to make. For example, it's a mistake to think the future takes care of itself. I used to think that. The fact is, of course, that the future is today's judgment day. It's today that molds and shapes the future. And then I thought, too, that there's always plenty of time, but that's not true either. The average person lives about 25,000 days, but a third of them are spent in sleep.
A third of life for sleep, another third for earning bread and butter, and a sixth for social obligations, as well as washing and eating and so on. That leaves you very little time. It may help us to realize that the first 20 years is the longest half of anybody's life. If you live to be 100, the first 20 years will be the longest half. You only have to think back as to how long those years were in your experience and in your memory and compare them with the last 20, and you'll see the truth of it. And so that's another stupid mistake that's easy to make, that there's plenty of time. And then there's the error that, well, it's the product that counts, not the producer. Or it's whether you can do the job, not how much you know. Today, every book on success warns us against these follies, because it's what I am that determines the product in the long run. And since 1957 and the Sputnik, we live in an information age. Karl Marx's stress on labour force has been replaced by information force. The importance of the Russian Sputnik in 1957 wasn't that we might experience space travel, oh no. It was that the world had moved into an information era, with the satellite communication being made possible. So it's not the job we can do, it's how much we know. 17% of the workforce was blue-collar workers in 1956. Today the over 80% are in the information industries. Lawyers, physicians, accountants, and so on. Over 80%. So our world has changed drastically, and it is very important what we know. Far more important than what we think we can do. Well, most of the books on success talk about these, but they give an overruling dual principle that's meant to protect us from such follies. The principle of prioritization, the other side of which is limitation. Let me talk about it briefly. It is a great revelation to learn that 80% of the things we do in life only has 20% of importance. And 20% of the things we do in life have 80% importance. The genius lies in discriminating which is the 80 and which is the 20. But woe to the person that does not learn to apply this principle of putting first first. And I didn't say first things first, because maybe things aren't first at all. Limitation goes along with prioritization. By limitation we mean this, that genius is intensity. Digression is as dangerous as stagnation. The person that chases two hares catches neither. The secret of success is focusing one's attention on a topic until we've burnt a hole in it, like a magnifying glass takes the sun's rays and burns a hole in paper. It's only when the water of the river stays within its banks that it creates power. It's only when electricity, instead of being diffused like lightning, is confined to a slender wire that it has power. Limitation is saying, concentrate. Remember that mastery is a result of resolved limitation. They asked a violinist how long it took him to become a good violinist. He said 12 hours a day for 20 years. He concentrated. None of us can do everything. None of us can go everywhere. We need to find what we can do well and concentrate on it. Genius is intensity. Genius is concentration.
We must learn to oppose to the death the petty larceny of our life by trifles.
One of the greatest inventions in media is the remote control whereby you can turn off the ads. Oppose to the death the petty larceny of your life by trifles. Remember, there are 10,000 things that invite time and attention from which we must turn away. If we neglect these principles of prioritization and limitation, we bring upon ourselves stress that can destroy us. 70 to 90% of diseases are initiated or exacerbated by stress. What is stress? It's the pressure from outside that makes you feel sick inside. The pressure also that gets things done, though it gets us undone. Stress is the friction of two things rubbing together, and you and I are rubbing together with people and things all day long. That's stress. Sartre said, hell is other people. That's stress. He should have also said, heaven is other people. But he omitted to say that. You can take a test in 2 minutes straight as to whether by neglect of the principles of prioritization and limitation, your life has too much stress, which will ultimately undo you while you are trying to do so much. Here's the very simple test. You remember the old ammeters on the dashboard of a car that told you whether the battery was charging or discharging? We're going to take a stress ammeter test. I'm going to mention several characteristics, and I've experienced them all, and you have too. And they're not important as isolated factors. They're tremendously important when they come into the light in a clump. When we have many of these factors characteristic of our daily existence, we're having so much stress, we're going to undo ourselves. Sickness is inevitable. So take the test with me. I have failed it many a time. Here are the signs when your nervous ammeter, because of excessive stress, is discharging vitality at such a rapid rate that you will shortly be undone unless you change things and turn to the principle of prioritization, the other side of which is limitation. So here are the signs. Remember, none of these on their own are significant, but when they come in a cluster, they're a red light. They're a red alert. Here they are. Irritability without known cause. If you're a wife, you've probably seen this in your husband many times. And some husbands have seen it in their wives. Irritability without known cause, number one. Number two, difficulty in concentrating. You don't want to read anything too heavy. Give me the comics. Put on the TV. Difficulty in concentrating. Third, difficulty in remembering names. And I'm always conscience-stricken when I remember this, because I fail at this. Every place I go, I fail at this. Increasing difficulty in remembering names of familiar people. You'd be surprised. You can even forget the name of someone that's related to you closely. Headaches. Very few headaches are caused by brain tumors. They're almost all caused by excessive stress. Indigestion. Doctors have carried out innumerable operations on people complaining of digestive problems. In 99 cases out of 100, there's no pathological cause. It's just too much stress. Fatigue. The main cause for weariness is not work. It's worry. Not work. Very, very few people are ever fatigued by work. But all of us get fatigued by worry. Mild depression. Now, of course, some depression can be hormonal and can be chemically aided. But the ordinary variety that we all suffer from is usually a sign of excessive stress. And then finally, insomnia. Now, insomnia can be sometimes a hereditary factor, multiple causes, but insomnia can be a product of too much stress. Now, let me run through them very quickly again. Here are the signs that your vitality is being dissipated at too fast a rate because you are neglecting the principle of prioritization and limitation. Here they are again.
irritability without known cause, difficulty in concentration, difficulty in remembering names, headache, indigestion, fatigue, depression, insomnia. I repeat, none of them significant on their own. We all have them. But if you have them as a cluster, you'll soon be undone. What should we do when we find such a cluster in our lives? Three things to remember. One, diversify the stressful agent. A single stressor that never is remitted, that has no pause, allowed to continue in the life, can destroy us. We must diversify the stressful agent. Go and run. It's impossible to retain a strong emotion when you're physically relaxed. Medicos tell us today that for most people, a 30-minute walk will do them much better than Valium. Imitate the last sleeping cat you saw. Pick it up and it sags at both ends. You can't help but feel relaxed after you've been physically active. So diversify the stressful agent. Don't let it all be on your mind. Use the muscles. There should be the same proportion of stress on muscles as there is on nerves. Otherwise, health will give way. Much stress on the nerves needs much stress on the muscles. So diversify the stressful agent. Secondly, interrupt the stresses by rest. The more important your work, the more important rest. Your capacity for work is determined by your capacity to rest. Rest is not doing nothing. Rest is repair. Rest is stepping back so you can jump further. Rest is tarrying a while so you'll finish sooner. Thirdly, reinterpret. Oh, most of our stresses come because we misinterpret things. Two men looked out through prison bars and one saw mud and the other saw stars. When the boys were wounded on the Anzio bridgehead in Italy in World War II, it only took a quarter of the amount of the morphine to ease their pain as if the same wounds had happened in civilian life. Why? Because they saw their wounds as a sick at home. It isn't what happens to us, it's how we interpret what happens to us. It's not the program being highly stressed and terrible tension. It's the psychology of the person in the program that determines everything. It's not what happens to us. It's what we do with what happens to us. So we must learn to reinterpret the stress. If we don't take these steps and continue the mad melee of life, forgetting to prioritize, forgetting that 80% of what we do only has 20% importance. In other words, 80% of things you do could be left undone and you wouldn't notice the loss. But if we don't wake up to this, health will fail us. And remember, in a typical group like this one in Australia, 3 out of 4 will die of cancer and heart disease. 3 out of 4. And these are not mysterious illnesses for the most part. We know what causes over 95% of cancer. If you don't smoke, you've wiped out a third of the likelihood of getting cancer. If you're not greatly into alcohol, you're not going to be among that 10% that die from alcohol. If you don't eat heavily of animal products, you've reduced your chances of an early death by about 60%. So when I say that in the typical audience, 3 out of 4 will die of heart disease or cancer, we choose to. It's our choice. Because we haven't learned to prioritize. And knowing what makes for life and knowing what causes death should be among our priorities. Let me tell you all they know about nutrition in one sentence. Because what we put between our lips determines 9 out of 10 deaths. What we put between our lips. The cigarette, excessive alcohol, excessive use of animal products. It's what we put between our lips that causes 9 out of 10 deaths. So here's the best they know on nutrition. And it's agreed on now the world around. This is not open to dispute. It wasn't my boyhood. I began to read in this area when I was about 9 years of age. And today it is a complete revolution. But here's all they know on nutrition. Eat fresh, whole food, chiefly of vegetable origin. Fresh, because the body doesn't make vitamin C. Your dog's body does, but your body doesn't. My body doesn't. You get vitamin C in fresh food. We must have fresh food every day. You want to be alive, eat live food. You want to be dead, eat dead food. You want to die early, eat stuff mainly out of packets, cans and bottles. You want to live long and be alive and vital, only have a minimum of stuff out of packets, cans and bottles, because that's all been killed to some degree. There's a principle in the good book says that what God has joined together should never be put asunder. Well, our whole food industry violates that principle. Eat fresh, whole food. Why whole? As soon as we begin to refine food, we rob that food of certain elements necessary for our survival. The body needs 50 different elements to survive, to function well. 50! And once we strip foods, you know, white flour, they take out about 22 elements and put back 6 and call it enriched. We are certainly a brainwashed generation. The old couplet, the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead, is not far wrong. You imagine, take out about 20 elements and put back 6 and call it enriched. That's crazy. You cannot process food without causing weakness and lack of vitality to the consumer. Eat fresh, whole food. Almost everybody in this country, in USA, and every civilized country on earth has the makings of diverticulitis, which is the pouches in diverticulosis, mainly caused through constipation, mainly caused by eating refined foods. And ultimately you get bowel cancer. They're the steps. You eat refined foods, you get constipation, you probably have appendix removed, then diverticulosis, and then diverticulitis, and then bowel cancer. That's it. Because we eat refined foods. Eat fresh, whole food, chiefly of vegetable origin. Why that? Because the main cause of death is the excessive use of animal products. You don't have to be a vegetarian, but the nearer you get to it, the healthier you'll be. And what's more, you'll have more hours in the day. Far more hours in the day. The banana-eating monkey sleeps 6 hours a day. The meat-eating lion sleeps 20. As a general principle, the nearer you get to vegetarianism, the less sleep you can manage on. Very important practical thing. Time is money. It's worth more than money. It's easier to get money than it is to get time. Queen Elizabeth supposed to have said the first, £1 million for a moment of time on a deathbed, but, you know, time can't be bought. So eat fresh, whole food, chiefly of vegetable origin. You can't be efficient, successful, if your health is going down the tubes. Everything's dependent on energy. Someone said if I could made a new god, I'd rear a statue to energy and worship that. But energy springs from good health. Good health springs from right habits. And it's mainly what you eat and what you think and whether you move. Here's one to remember. They never bury anything that moves. They never bury anything that moves. The good book says, in the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat bread. If you don't sweat, don't eat. It's estimated 300,000 people a year die in the US because they're couch potatoes. Less than 1 in 4 Americans do anything like the exercise that's necessary. Despite one of the founding fathers and one of the early presidents, Jefferson, saying at least 2 hours a day of physical activity is necessary for health. At least 2 hours a day. They never bury anything that moves. In the sweat of thy brow shall thou eat. If you don't sweat, don't eat. Now, let me go further and say that even if we think we're applying these principles of prioritization and limitation, we may still miss the mark. John D. Rockefeller was a millionaire by the time he was 33. He had built the biggest monopoly in the world, the Standard Oil Company, by the time he was 43. By the time he was 53, he was dying. He wore a skull cap and a wig. His skin was like parchment. He lived for a while on mother's milk, She was earning $1 million a week. His food cost $2 a week. Crackers and acidulated milk was the best he could do. He had a mysterious digestive ailment that took all the hair of his head, all his eyelashes, left him just a wisp in the eyebrow. Why? He was the most hated man in America, particularly in the oil fields of Pennsylvania, where they hanged him in effigy. And being hated and unloved, plus the worry of his work, he never put his head on the pillow without worrying about whether he would lose his fortune, these destroyed his health. So the doctor said to him, Mr. Rockefeller, here's your choice. Keep your job and your money and die, or give up your job and risk your wealth and live. So he retired at 53. They gave him three rules to live by. Mr. Rockefeller, you're not to worry about anything under any circumstances, ever. Rule number one. Number two, get enough rest, but exercise regularly in the open air. Number three, be careful how you eat, and always eat a little less than you want. John D. Rockefeller changed his whole life. And when he had time, now he's retired, he began to wonder, could money bring happiness? It had brought him near to death. Could money bring happiness? So you know the rest. Rockefeller Foundation, pursuing disease, wiped out hookworm in America. Have done things all around the globe that are wonderful. Was John Dee contented when he changed his lifestyle and learned to give rather than to get? First time in his life he was contented. Now he practiced prioritization of a type and limitation of a type. The only thing that he ever did was make money and teach Sunday school. But he'd missed the boat. You know J.C. Penney, who started the Penney Stores. Penny, when his life was about halfway through, counted that he didn't have a friend in the world, he'd lost all his self-respect, he had shingles, he couldn't sleep, he was in a sanitarium, the Battle Creek Sanitarium in America, wrote letters to his wife and child, said, I don't think I'll live to see the morning. He'd been a hard-hitting businessman, but he realized he'd failed terribly. He did see the morning, and he heard someone or some group singing songs. So he made his way down to the little chapel of Battle Creek Sanitarium. And the tiny congregation of patients there were singing, God will take care of you. Then came a scripture reading about a God who counts the hairs of our head, and who attends the funeral of every sparrow, and who so loved the world that he gave his son. And J.C. Penney recording it says, suddenly, I was lifted out of hell into paradise. Suddenly, the darkness was dispatched, and I was in brilliant light, and aware as I was that I was responsible for my own troubles, and hating myself for my stupidity, my folly, my weakness, my failures. He said, suddenly, I came to see that the creator of the universe thought I was valuable, cared for me, wanted the best for me. He said, from that day to this, I haven't worried. That's what he said when he was 72 years of age. You've heard of Goethe, a great American writer, a great German writer who wrote Dr. Faustus, admired by kings and presidents and generals and everybody. Man of marvelous genius. At the end of his life, in his 80s, he said, I've not had three happy months in my whole life. He practiced prioritization of a type and limitation, but he failed, like Rockefeller, like J.C. Penney. Not enough to know those principles in their outward form. Napoleon had glory, fame, wealth. On St. Helena, he said, I haven't had 6 days of happiness in my life. Contrast Helen Keller. Blind, deaf, and dumb. She said, in her old age, I have found life so beautiful. What made the difference? We need to understand our human nature, what makes us tick. Every decision you and I make is to avoid anxiety. Conscious or unconscious, to avoid anxiety. The anxiety of unhappiness, the anxiety of self-despair, the anxiety of the lack of love, but above all, the anxiety of separateness. You see, we're born without choosing to be born, we die without choosing to die, either our loved ones die before we do, or we die before them, and subconsciously there's born in on us the awareness that we are lonely, isolated people in a universe that's immense and seemingly merciless. And the human organism, from the time it leaves the womb, is struggling to get back. Our parents were meant to shape us to deal with this problem. The mother represents unconditional love. Doesn't matter what you do, your mother loves you still. The father represents conditional love. He represents the world of discipline, cause and effect, sowing and reaping. And the child, as it matures, is meant to have both a mother principle and a father principle. Can accept itself despite its follies. You know, we're all stupid in lots of ways. There are no exceptions. But the mother principle, properly developed, says, hey, if God can love me, I can accept myself, despite my stupidities. The father principle says, that's true, but you got to deal with the world out there. Now get cracking, obey the law, do this, work, rest, prioritization. If we lack the proper development of either of these two, the mother principle or the father principle, we are neurotic in one way or another. If we've been exposed to smother love, a mother that's too domineering, with a weak, disinterested father, we grow up always looking for a mother. We grow up liable to depression, liable to hysteria, unable to cope, always messing things up. If we grow up, on the other hand, with a highly dominating father and a recessive mother, we are likely to become obsessive, cold. The problem with this issue of learning to love aright, which is the real solution to the problem of separateness, the problem with the first thought of solution is that there's no enterprise in the world that's associated with as many failures as love. Love, as Hollywood presents it, is not what the great thinkers of the world mean by love. Love, as Hollywood presents, makes towering promises that are false. You fall in love with the right boy, the right girl, you'll be in ecstasy forever. Absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. The state of infatuation is never lasting, or how would we get anything done? Never lasting. Nature starts every new procedure off with an explosion. And the same is true about generating the next generation. But the promises made by erotic passion are false. That once you've found the ideal mate, all rest of life will be just honey and sugar and strawberries and cream. Rubbish. Sheer rubbish. And furthermore, the lie goes on to say, once I find him or find her, you know, people only think about four bare legs in a bed. Everything else is lost. And I think if only we can do this, I'll not only have repeated ecstasies, I'll have lifelong satisfaction. Sheer rubbish. Sheer rubbish. The creator of the universe told us a better way. You know, in Thornton Wilder's book, Woman of Andros, the hero is walking out in the dark and he's thinking of all the messes his fellows have made in their marriages and their jobs. And he raises his hands to heaven, what should I do? How should I live? Wouldn't it be great if the universe told us? Wouldn't it be great if the creator came down and gave it to us 2 minutes straight? He did. He did. In 2 minutes, he did it. Oh, you say those old Ten Commandments. Oh, no, no, no. At Mount Sinai, the creator of the universe told us three things. Happiness is causal, not casual. The universe is a universe, not a multiverse. It's run by law. And the primary law is that of unselfish, disciplined love. When God gave the Ten Commandments, he was telling us this. If you want to handle the stress and distresses of life,